This Week, Aaron Sorkin. Tonight at 8:30 on Bloomberg Television.
You're watching Bloomberg West, where we focus on innovation, technology, and the future of business. I'm Corey Johnson. Well, President Obama is promising aggressive action to introduce immigration reform, but Republicans are not in favor of that idea. House Speaker John Boehner just said, quote, the president will burn himself with immigration reform. Well, I sat down with Congressman Lamar Smith today. The Texas Republican has been an outspoken critic of the president. He also voted against increasing the number of H-1B visas.
I think it's disappointing that the president is threatening Congress and threatening the American people with these executive orders. According to the public opinion polls, three quarters of the American people do not think the president should try to rewrite immigration laws by himself. He shouldn't go it alone. He should work with Congress, and then we can come up with a good product. But you know, these kind of threats, if Congress doesn't do something, then I'm going to do something myself. The president himself has said he doesn't have the authority to do that. Several times in the last several years, he said he's told groups that he's met with, I can't issue these executive orders. It's contrary to the Constitution. It's contrary to my oath of office. I hope you'll go back and read what he said.
But now he's obviously saying he's going to push ahead. What are you going to do? Are you going to defund those programs? Are you going to keep those programs from going into effect even if he does enact things with executive order?
Yeah, if the president pushes ahead with these immigration executive orders and gives amnesty to millions of people and work permits to millions of people who are going to obviously compete with unemployed and underemployed Americans, there's going to be a price to be paid. We might try to defund what he does. We'll obviously try a lawsuit. There may be actions we can take otherwise. But this is when he does this, he's just going to poison the barrel and make it awfully hard to work with him on other issues, and particularly immigration. And so if he wants to accomplish anything lasting on immigration, then he's going to have to work with Congress and not just issue these executive orders.
All right, so there was a bill approved by the Senate that won't come for a vote because John Boehner won't let it come for a vote in the House. The current House, the president says the current House, he's got the votes there right now. Would you vote for that bill if it comes before you during this current Congress, during the session?
The Senate bill, the Senate amnesty bill from early this Congress, actually cannot be sent to the House because it's unconstitutional. It's contrary to the Constitution for the Senate to include revenue increasing measures in their legislation. So the reason that the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid hasn't sent it to the House is he knows that we can't take it up. We're opposed to that bill because it is massive amnesty, and it never really secures the border. It says after 5 years, if the border's not secure, then there'll be a study made. Well, we can't have that kind of, you know, putting off the secure borders, meanwhile giving amnesty to millions of people, which is just going to encourage more people to come into the country illegally. We need to start over, secure the border first. I mean, even under this administration, the government accounting office has said that only 15% of the border is under full control. That's why we have hundreds of thousands of people coming across the border illegally every year right now under this administration. So secure the border first, then we can talk about these other measures.
Would granting amnesty hurt the American workforce?
If the president grants amnesty by himself, rewrites the laws by himself, which I believe and he knows is unconstitutional and contrary to his oath of office, that is absolutely going to hurt unemployed Americans and underemployed Americans. Almost every study done, when you have that many more people getting work permits, it's going to have two harmful impacts on American workers. It's going to depress their wages, and it's going to cost them jobs. And that's irrefutable, and I'm surprised and disappointed the president isn't going to put the American worker first.
I ran across a quote from yours, and I don't know the context. I'll read it briefly. It's about the DREAM Act, which allows children who have graduated from U.S. high schools who were born overseas or people who served in the military to get some sort of conditional citizenship, those who are, in fact, good moral citizens. Yeah. You called it a nightmare for the American people. Is that an accurate quote, and what do you mean by that?
Well, the so-called DREAM Act, to me, is a nightmare for a couple of reasons. First of all, it basically gives amnesty to anyone in the country who's under 30 years old who claim they came in when they were younger. And the administration, when we quizzed them before the Judiciary Committee, said, yes, there's really no way for them to double-check to try to avoid the fraudulent documents that everybody would use. So it's an open invitation to massive fraud. It's an open invitation to about half the people in the country to say they came in when they were or younger and get amnesty. Plus, everybody in this category is also getting work permits, and then they'll be competing with American workers or driving down their wages. So this kind of a piece of legislation should not be done alone, should not be done in isolation, and we shouldn't be doing any kind of bill like this. It's just going to encourage more people to come into the country illegally.
That was Congressman Lamar Smith. Well, if immigration reform is not passed, could the U.S. lose the creators of the next big thing in technology? We're going to discuss that next on Bloomberg West.
Everything was as easy as creating your website with Wix. Go to Wix.com today. It's free.
For tapping into a wealth of experience. For access to one of the top wealth management firms in the country. For a team of financial professionals who provide customized solutions. For all of your wealth management and retirement goals, discover how PNC Wealth Management can help you achieve. Visit PNC.com/wealth solutions to find out more.
At CVS Health, we took a deep breath and made the decision to quit selling cigarettes in our CVS pharmacies. Now we invite smokers to quit, too, with our comprehensive program. We just want to help everyone, everywhere, breathe a little easier. Introducing CVS Health, because health is everything.
Breitling, instruments for professionals.
I think that the Malaysian government creates a very business-friendly environment. They've been working alongside us throughout the 40 over years. We wouldn't be where we are today without that support. And obviously, that support would continue.
Malaysia is at the forefront of success. We have very talented people, world-class infrastructure, and we provide a very strategic environment for businesses to grow.
Hi, I'm Barry Sloan of Newtek, the Small Business Authority. As a small business owner, you know how difficult getting a bank loan can be. With a simple phone interview, we can pre-qualify you in 48 hours. That's why we're the nation's largest non-bank government-guaranteed lender. So whether you need $5 million or $50,000, you can count on Newtek, the Small Business Authority. Call us at 8552-THESBA or visit us at THESBA.com.
What does Silicon Valley get that other industries don't yet?
Bloomberg's Emily Chang sits down with the biggest influencers in technology and media.
Honestly, in the beginning, we were not trying to make money.
It was all an experiment. You think that you may live to 120.
I certainly hope to, yes.
I'm a little paranoid of not being needed and wanted, I guess.
For candid conversations about how they made it and where they're going next, Studio 1.0. This week, Aaron Sorkin. Tonight at 8:30 on Bloomberg Television.
This is Bloomberg West. I'm Corey Johnson in for Emily Chang. Well, hundreds of thousands of foreign-born students flocked to the United States to be educated only to take those educations back to countries like India and China and work in science and engineering. That's one of a half million skilled immigrants, wait for a work visa. Our next guest says the real loser here is the United States and calls those students hostages to the political process. Vivek Wadhwa, author of The Immigrant Exodus and a fellow at Stanford Law School, joins me right now. Vivek, great to see you as always. This issue, you know, I remember, 15 years ago, John Doerr saying, why don't we just take every Stanford graduate and staple a green card to their diploma to keep them here to help them invent new companies?
Corey, it's a tragedy that the U.S. is losing competitiveness. Just when we need to be creating jobs and boosting the economy, we're boosting the economies of other countries. You may remember about 4 years ago, you and I talked about Kunal Bal, who went back to India from Wharton because he couldn't get a visa. And his company now is worth more than Groupon. He was starting the Groupon of India. His company is worth more than Groupon is. We were talking over drinks about whether they should buy Groupon or not. This is how much the world has changed.
And that is a business that could have been here, perhaps. One of the issues which we've been talking about all hour is this idea that a comprehensive immigration reform can't seem to get through Congress, but the Democrats don't want to let go of the sort of enticement of the H-1B visa issue that a lot of Republicans might be willing to go along with. What do you think about that? I mean, from a sentimental point of view, I'm sure that you also support the idea of comprehensive reform, but is it the right political solution?
You know, comprehensive means a lot of things. The problem is that the Democrats insisted on citizenship in there. They put a poison pill in there that the Republicans couldn't agree to. If they had just gone to the Republicans and said, look, let's do the DREAM Act, it's urgent, these kids, did nothing wrong, the Republicans would agree to that. If they went and said, look, we've got 10 million people over here, we're not going to throw them out, we need to legalize them and let them pay taxes and let them go home and visit their relatives, let's come up with some temporary legalization program, they would have agreed to that. The fact that the Democrats insisted on citizenship bracket voting rights so that they could get votes and they held skilled immigrants hostage is what created the problem. I'm hoping that with the Senate victory, now more sense prevails. The Democrats start backing off and not demanding all or nothing. They don't hold the skilled immigrants hostage, that we finally can get immigration reform. I'm hopeful for a change because of the Senate victory of the Republicans.
Vivek, can you paint a picture for me of the typical H-1B visa holder or applicant? What is that person like? Where are they from? Tell me more.
Corey, H-1B is a mixed bag because you have the anti-immigrant groups protesting against it, and they have valid points because the H-1B does get abused. But H-1B is also used to bring in the bright people we need in Silicon Valley. You know, the engineers, the scientists, the doctors, all of these amazing people who start companies. So it's a mixed bag, some abuse, overall a lot of good because we end up bringing in bright young people from all over the world who are at the beginning of their careers, or who are about to peak in their careers, who bring their energy and their knowledge with them, and they contribute to American success. So it's people from all over the world. And it's really the type of people you see in Silicon Valley, from every country you can think of, but they're here to build value and to grow. This is why they come over here to America, because it's a land of opportunity. It's good for America.
We just interviewed Lamar Smith, congressman from Texas, who said that H-1B visas cost jobs of Americans that might otherwise go to Americans. Is that true, or do they create jobs?
No, Smith is ignorant. He's listening to these anti-immigrants who take the examples of a few, corrupt companies and a few people who sneaked in through the, through the H-1B system who are abusing the privilege. Yes, there is the abuse. But he doesn't come to Silicon Valley. I don't think that he even knows where Silicon Valley is, because if he did, if he came over here and met the companies here, met the entrepreneurs here, met the startups over here, he would realize that, hey, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that there is value in these skilled immigrants. So he's ignorant. That's how simple it is.
And when it comes to sort of the H-1B visas, would an expansion of that, you talked about the abuses, would an expansion also expand those abuses? Maybe you can elaborate a little bit more about what those abuses are.
Corey, the real problem here isn't the H-1B visa. The real problem is the number of green cards. I blame the technology companies for muddying the waters over here, focusing on H-1B visas and not green cards. We have about a million, million and a half people stuck in limbo, people who are on H-1B visas or other visas who are waiting for green cards. here's what the problem is, that while they wait for green cards, they really can't change jobs because they risk going to the back of the line. It could take 10 or 20 years for them to get a green card. In the meantime, they're working for these companies. The companies are fat and happy because normally computer programmers only last for 2 or 3 years and they have to keep giving them salary increases, otherwise they'll leave. So these people are stuck in the same jobs, in the same dreaded professions they did when they started their career, and they held hostage to the companies. So the problem we need to fix is to get more green cards for the workers who are already in America. Getting more H-1Bs is good, but we should focus on those green cards first. And also on H-1Bs, we should give, we should favor Silicon Valley startups. We should favor technology companies over the IT shops, over the service companies that hire these companies and these people and then lease them out. So the shades of gray over here, but overall, we need more skilled immigrants, and that's good for America.
Let's take a minute to sort of focus on that. There's companies like Cognizant Technology Solutions, which does just that, which is sort of an outsourcing business. Most of the work is done in India, a lot of it done in the U.S., and they get a lot of these H-1B visas for those workers. Talk to me about why that's a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing because most of the people that Cognizant places are at good companies and there's very little abuse. There might be some abuse, but there's very little abuse over there. Cognizant is not the problem. The problem is these sleazy body shops in New Jersey and elsewhere who bring in people, inflate their resumes, and put them at, pay them low salaries and take advantage of them. That's where the problem is. And that's what the anti-immigrant groups harp on, and that's what Lamar Smith uses as an example to press his anti-immigrant agenda.
And obviously a leaky bucket such as immigration is going to have a lot of variant holes.
Every government program has holes. Medicare has holes, but we don't argue about stopping Medicare. We don't stop, the tax system has holes. Companies try to evade taxes. We don't say we want to abolish taxes or do something stupid over here. Every program has abuse. So does the H-1B program. But that doesn't mean that we cut off America's lifeblood, which is immigration. It's immigrants who have made this country what it is from the beginning of America. It's people who came here wave after wave. They made the natives compete harder, work harder, think smarter, and compete. And the natives always resented them, as you're seeing Lamar Smith and these anti-immigrants do right now. They try to close the doors, saying, it was fine when we came here. We don't want any more. The future people are taking our jobs away. What the new immigrants do is that they make the natives work harder. They say that, look, you're not entitled to your job. Anyone can have the same job who's qualified, who works hard. So the best win. And this is what makes America what it is, this capitalism, this freedom, this constant innovation and competition. This is why America is the greatest country in the world, because of immigrants like us.
You're right. It's a story as old as America itself. Vivek Wadhwa, author of The Immigrant Exodus and a fellow at Stanford Law School. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it. Well, coming up, screenwriter Aaron Sorkin on his first interactions with Steve Jobs as he takes on the challenging project of writing the Jobs biopic. That's next on Bloomberg West.
I've spent my career analyzing markets, investigating global businesses, and interviewing today's most important leaders.
Tell me about that transition you made.
One thing I've learned is that despite language, culture, or ways of life, the global economy connects us all.
What does a housing recovery look like?
I want to help you understand today's world to better prepare you for tomorrow. Join me on Street Smart, only on Bloomberg Television.
Our first trip to Sandals, and he forgets his wallet. What are we going to do now? So, we didn't need the wallet. Maybe I should apologize to him. Well, let's not get carried away.
Save up to 65%. Call 1-800-SANDALS.
You take all your business calls yourself. Sort of makes it hard to look professional or get anything done. By helping to expertly manage your incoming calls, eVoice provides you with a better way to connect, regardless of whether you're a business of one or 100. We connect all incoming calls to eVoice instead of directly to you. So wherever you are, at home, the office, or on the road, you'll never miss a call. Get started with your 60-day free trial now at evoice.com. Enter promo code TV60 and get the first 60 days free.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
Gunderman Group.
Gunderman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
The goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups. They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time?
Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 Awesome. Awesome.
I love logistics.
We all think about life insurance, but when we start worrying about tomorrow, we miss out on the things that matter today. At AXA, we offer advice and help you break down your insurance goals into small, manageable steps. Because when you plan for tomorrow, it helps you live for today. Can we help you take a small step? For advice, retirement, and life insurance, connect with AXA.
Welcome back to Bloomberg West. I'm Corey Johnson. Well, he's written some of the most famous lines in American film history, like Few Good Men, You Can't Handle the Truth. Who could forget that? Screenwriter Aaron Sorkin. Also behind The West Wing, The Social Network. And now the long-rumored Steve Jobs biopic. It's going to be a real thing. Emily Chang sat down with him to talk about what's going on with this new movie and the latest edition of Studio 1.0. It's going to be on tonight. Here's a sneak peek.
There have been so many books written about Steve Jobs. There's been another movie about Steve Jobs starring Ashton Kutcher. Why do you think there is more of a story to tell?
I think that you could do 10 more movies about Steve Jobs. And I think if you lined up 10 writers and said, write a movie about Steve Jobs, you'd get 10 different movies, all of them worth going to see.
Did you ever meet Steve Jobs?
I spoke to him on the phone 3 times. The first time he called me, it was because I gave an interview in which I said, everything I've ever written, I've written on a Mac. And he called me to thank me for saying that and asked me if he could send me, they were coming out with a new laptop. And he said, let me send you this thing and just play around with it and tell me what you think. The second time he called me, it was to invite me up to the Bay Area to tour Pixar. He wanted to know if I'd be interested in writing a Pixar movie. And the third time he called me was to ask me to help him write his commencement address at Stanford.
You helped him write that?
Honestly, I fixed a couple of typos in the speech.
I was there that day.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, my sister was graduating that day.
Oh, wow.
I saw that.
That's amazing.
Beautiful.
Yeah, but I don't want to suggest for a moment that any of those thoughts were my thoughts. That is the brain of Steve Jobs, and I helped him put the music to it.
How hard a character is that to write? How hard is that to bring to life? How much pressure is that? I'm not putting any pressure on you.
The same pressure that I feel when I'm writing anything, and maybe with a little bit of sauce on top of pressure, because he is a person that so many people have so many strong feelings about. But I've met everyone and spent a lot of time with the other seven characters who are in the movie, like Woz. Joanna Hoffman, who's a fantastic character. She was the head of marketing for the Mac team. John Sculley, who was the CEO of Apple and became famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, for firing Steve Jobs from Apple. He's a wonderful man and a great character. And in this movie, Jobs has conflicts with all of them that get dramatized and worked out in a very compressed, very claustrophobic environment.
You might have to wait for the movie, but you don't have to wait for Studio 1.0 with Aaron Sorkin is on tonight at 8:30 p.m. on the East Coast and on the West Coast. Well, the BYU Bite, one number that tells us a whole lot. Our chief Washington correspondent, Peter Cook, joins me now from the Russell Rotunda in Washington, D.C. with today's number. Peter, we're talking about immigration, so I hope this is immigration related. What have you got?
That's right. The BYU Bite today is 85,000. That is the current H-1B visa cap in this country. I've been talking about it all day long. Big effort here on Capitol Hill outside of Washington to try and raise that number. And real questions here in Washington about whether or not that's even going to be possible in the next Congress.
Yeah, it's a big issue out here, too, and a lot of questions. We're just talking about the abuses of that program as well. John Boehner just spoke a few minutes ago, and the president's saying he's pushing ahead with immigration reform, hell or high water. Anything about the prospects of some kind of an immigration deal coming up?
Very interesting comments from John Boehner. Now, his first on-camera response to what happened on election night and the immigration issue front and center at his news conference. He was asked about immigration reform, said, listen, I want to move on this. This is an issue we got to deal with in this Congress. But he gave a pretty strict warning to the president that if the president acts on his own, those executive orders dealing with folks of the deportation issue, it's really going to muck things up. Take a listen to John Boehner, his warning to the president.
I believe that the president continues to act on his own, he is going to poison the well. When you play with matches, you take the risk of burning yourself. And he's going to burn himself if he continues to go down this path. The American people made it clear on Election Day. They want to get things done, and they don't want the president acting on a unilateral basis.
Bottom line, he does that executive order on immigration, Corey, then not only immigration issues in trouble, any cooperation next year would be in trouble.
There's a battle brewing here. It's coming soon. All right, Peter, thank you very much for the bite. What fun that was. I remember you can always get the latest headlines all the time on your phone, tablet, at Bloomberg.com and on Bloomberg Radio. We'll see you tomorrow with more Bloomberg West.
The true partner is the one you feel most comfortable with. Invest in remarkable Indonesia.
Invest in America's oil boom with Black Gold Resources. Oil is the world's most prized natural resource. In fact, oil prices have tripled over the last decade alone. Savvy investors are growing their portfolios with steady monthly income and up to 100% write-off of their investment through oil well ownership. Now, with escalating global tensions and rising worldwide demand, experts say that higher oil and gasoline prices are here to stay. Now is the time to hedge against this endless price inflation. If you're a qualified investor looking for steady monthly income that could last for decades with returns of up to 30% or more and have at least $30,000 to start, call us now at 800-OIL-9505. That's 800-OIL-9505. Learn how black gold can power your portfolio. Call 800-645-9505. 800-645-9505.
Ally Bank really has no hidden fees on savings accounts.
That's right.
It's just that I'm worried about, you know, hidden things.
Okay, why's that?
No hidden fees from the bank where no branches equals great rates.
Eliminate your monthly phone bill with Magic Jack. Simply connect your internet and landline phone to Magic Jack to start making crystal clear phone calls. The all-new Magic Jack Go includes 1 year of free digital phone service. Download the free Magic Jack app and your home calls ring on your smartphone. Click or visit Radio Shack today.
I took my first handful of pills, and that's when all my priorities seemed to change.
He would ask to use the bathroom in other people's homes.
He just assumed that they would have medication.
He'd go in their medicine cabinets and steal prescription drugs.
I wish I knew really what these prescription pills were.
We were so naive about the whole drug thing.
These are all synthetic forms of heroin.
Keep your medication locked up because you'll never notice that a pill is gone.
Mind your meds. Learn more from the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids.
I am so glad that Jen set us up.
Yeah.
So how do you guys know each other?
Jen and I went to summer camp together.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah.
You know, I never lost a Maccabiah.
Oh, whoa.
I know,
watch
right?
out. What's Maccabiah?
Oh, man. I am tired.
You know, I never lost a Maccabiah.
Color Wars?
You know what that is?
Yeah, we call it Maccabiah, too.
Do you want to go out and grab a drink?
Yes. Do you want to meet my parents?
If you trade stocks and options online, we'd like to have a word with you. Trade King. We're different from the five biggest online brokers. Trade King lets you trade wisely, just $4.95 per trade. Trade smoothly, with customer service ranked number one by Smart Money. Trade easily, with an award-winning website that's easy to use. Switch today and get $1,000 in free trade commissions. Looking for a new breed of broker? There's a name for people like you. Trade King. Switch today.
Around the clock, around the world, Bloomberg keeps you connected on television, online, on the radio, and on mobile.
You are a business pro, solver of the slice, teacher of the unteachable. You lower handicaps and raise hopes. And you rent from National, because only National lets you choose any car in the aisle and go. You can even take a full size or above and still pay the mid-size price.
Nice drive.
Well played, business pro. Well played. Go National. Go like a pro.
We think deeply to create advanced construction innovations. Making home even more enjoyable to live in. Meeting the world's highest standards. All to achieve quality customer satisfaction and global recognition. Think construction solution. Think Thailand.
Siri, play.
All new TLX from Acura.
From our studios in New York City, this is Charlie Rose.
The Republican Party swept to victory in yesterday's midterm elections. The GOP retook the Senate with ease. They also added enough House seats to earn their largest majority since World War II. And they won governor's races in blue states. The results were seen as a harsh referendum on President Obama, who had said that his policies were on the ballot. The president spoke earlier today about the new status quo in Washington.
The key is to make sure that those ideas that I have overlap somewhere with some of the ideas that Republicans have. There's not going to be perfect overlap. I mean, there are going to be some ideas that I've got that I think the evidence backs up would be good for the economy. And Republicans disagree. They're not going to support those ideas. But I'm going to keep on arguing for them because I think they're the right thing for the country to do. There are going to be some ideas that they've got that they believe will improve the economy or create jobs that, from my perspective, isn't going to help middle-class families improve their economic situation. So I probably won't support theirs. But I do think there are going to be areas where we do agree.
The president's remarks followed a press conference by the presumptive Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He struck a conciliatory note as well.
I always like to remind people that divided government is not unusual in this country. We've had it frequently. I think maybe even more often than not since World War II. When the American people choose divided government, I don't think it means they don't want us to do anything. I think it means they want us to look for areas of agreement.
Joining me now, Mark Halperin and John Heilman. They are the co-managing editors of Bloomberg Politics and host of With All Due Respect. I am pleased to have them back at this table. So let's begin with the results. What's interesting, surprising? What should we take note of?
Well, I mean, the scale of the Republican sweep
is pretty striking. And, you know, Mark and I were here on Monday, and we were saying, you know, we thought it was, the odds were better, more likely than not that Republicans would. But you couldn't be sure, and a lot of these races have been very close. It turned out that, you know, every contested Senate race the Republicans were in, except for New Hampshire, that they won them all, and Louisiana, which is going to a runoff. So they pretty much won a clean sweep, and they won by margins that were, in some cases, pretty tight, but in a lot of cases, much larger than we expected. They won in states that President Obama carried the last two times. They won in Iowa and they won in Colorado. They won more expected. Those are, to me, the most meaningful ones because of that fact. They won pretty much everywhere, I guess I say, except for up in New Hampshire. And so, you know, there's that their strategy, which had been to nationalize these elections around President Obama, was pretty much vindicated on the day. And it's part of why, you know, you see the president having to react in the way he did, because his name was not on the ballot. But, boy, he was in a lot of ads at the end, and he was the central issue in a lot of ways in the campaign.
But is it more than a Barack Obama? Is it really about people fed up with Washington, fed up with the way the system is working, and fed up with a sense that they think other people are doing better than they are?
It's definitely all those things. And the president said today, and he's quite right, as the party in power in the White House, they're going to take a lot of that, the brunt of that. But I think the Democratic Party also has some fundamental problems now about what it stands for, either as the Obama Democratic Party or just the Democratic Party in general. You looked at their candidates out there trying to find a message, and they would cherry pick. They'd try to link the Republicans to the Koch brothers, or they'd try to attack the Republicans for particular issue positions. But having an overarching theory of the case about what the Democratic Party stands for right now at this time in our history, derivative of the president's agenda, or again, just here's the party on its own, they really lacked a comprehensive national message. And the Republicans didn't have one either, except to run against the president. In a midterm, that was good enough.
So we've read a lot of post-election commentary today, including Peter Baker, who suggested that the president really had bridled at the idea he could not get involved, that he was on the sidelines, that he wanted to go out there and have at it and explain himself, his party, and his policies.
Yeah, well, and you look, the president has been like this throughout. You know, you think about in 2012, he was sometimes felt this way. He was frustrated about the fact that his campaign didn't want him to go out and argue the case on behalf of what he had accomplished for 4 years, and they tried to steer him away from that. And you know, you saw on one particularly dramatic instance is when he went to Northwestern University, my alma mater, and gave a speech 6 weeks ago or so, where he said this famous thing, where he said, you know, my name is not on the ballot, but my policies, every single one of them are on the ballot. And Democratic candidates around the country, like, were beating their heads against the table when he said that. They saw it as uniformly, they saw it as unhelpful. They were angry at the time, and now they are kind of lashing out in the press in some instances about how the White House is very clueless. And even within the White House, there is some confusion. The line was in the speech. It was not ad-libbed. But there's no one who could have seen that as helpful. You could predict the consequences of that, right? It was, not only was President Obama in a lot of ads, but that specific bite was in a lot of ads. And so...
So why didn't somebody catch that?
Well, I think it's not a question of whether somebody caught it. I think it's what the president wanted to say. And it goes to your point, Charlie, about he was frustrated about the fact that he was not welcome in these contested Senate races. He was frustrated about the fact that the Clintons were allowed to go everywhere else and were welcomed everywhere else and he was not. He feels that he was not happy to see the members of his own party running away from him in the way that they did. And, you know, you can imagine it personally, that he could not go back to Iowa, the state that launched him towards the Democratic nomination in 2008, a state that he won twice. The fact that he was so toxic that he couldn't go back to that state, which means a huge amount to him. You can't, you know, the personal level of frustration is understandable. And I think in various times heading up to Election Day, his frustration, he acted out in some ways. And that speech is one example of that, I think.
Clearly he's searching for common ground here. But what is his driven sense of trying to find common ground?
Well, driven's an interesting word. You know, he did a press conference today over an hour, and with the exception of his final answer, there wasn't a lot of sense that either of us had watching it, that there was drive there. You think about back to George Bush and Bill Clinton, both three two-term presidents in a row. Bill Clinton and George Bush each had one good midterm election, which is uncommon, even in a first midterm. Barack Obama's had two bad midterms. He didn't have a good one. After both of their bad midterms, they did press conferences where they were clearly on their game, energized, fighting for the balance of their presidency. I don't think you could have a reading of what President Obama did today about being driven to save it. His theory seems to be that now the Republicans need to govern with the pressure of 2016 coming, that they're going to make deals with him on a few things, and the muscles start to work, the relationships build enough, that maybe you pass an energy bill or an infrastructure bill, and then you can move on to some bigger issues. But I think that the reality is he can't be passive, and I thought he was relatively passive today. He's got to be the commander-in-chief of this and take charge. Now, there's a meeting Friday at the White House, and maybe that's when he'll take charge, but the symbolic moment of today in the history books, if you're writing the history of the last 2 years of this administration and you started with today, this was not a take charge moment.
It seemed perfunctory and rote through most of it. And he explicitly went out of his way not to say, I understand that in part the results yesterday are a reflection on me. He took no blame. He didn't say that there was a large message that he needed to change course. When he was asked if he would explicitly, are you ready to change how you do business? He basically said no. He basically said, I'm going to do what I've done all along, which is try to find common ground, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I get that there are principles around which
he said if Republicans come to him with ideas, he's willing to change.
Right.
But that's still pretty passive.
Right.
And no one
should expect the president, and there's not reasonable to expect the president to capitulate to Republicans now or to give up on his core principles, and he's not going to let them gut the Affordable Care Act. And that's totally understandable, but it is, as Mark said, there's just a kind of passivity around it. And even his description of the midterms, you know, he did not. He's kind of tried to cast it as kind of a bipartisan repudiation when it was just not that. And he even went and said at one point, well, I hear the two-thirds of you who didn't vote, as if to kind of almost minimize the importance of it. As if to say, well, two-thirds of the people didn't even vote in this election, so let's not pay as much attention to it. It didn't mean that much. I just don't think that he gave the impression to a lot of people, at least monitoring social media, Democrats and Republicans alike, that he was a little bit in denial. That's the impression. I don't think he necessarily is in denial, but the affect of the moment was that he wasn't really absorbing the magnitude of what happened.
And I'll tell you, the thing that I found the most startling was that there's a story in Politico today that quotes an administration official saying, you still have to worry about the base. The base comes first, the base of the Democratic Party. And I read that to one of the president's most trusted political advisors, and he was appalled. That someone on the president's behalf was saying that.
The day after the midterms.
I mean, the president doesn't have to all of a sudden endorse private Social Security accounts and the Keystone Pipeline. But there's no doubt, despite what his liberal supporters would like, there's no doubt that if he's going to make deals with Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, they're going to be more towards the center. And they're going to annoy some people in the president's base.
This is obviously an aide being quoted, so I don't know if the president would necessarily say this or not. But look, on a very pertinent issue right now, the president now is faced with the question of whether he's going to take executive action on immigration, right? Republicans tell us, you know, have been saying and have been telling other people, if the president, before the end of this year in the lame duck, does this executive action, it will poison the well on everything going forward. And yet, I think there's a reasonable chance he will do it, nonetheless. And I think what he's thinking is not that I'm trying to appease the base, but his attitude is, this is an issue of principle. I think that I'm right about it. And he's so cynical now about the ability to do a deal on something like immigration with this Republican Party that his attitude is, well, you know, I should do what he's right at this point because I'm never going to get a deal done. I'm not endorsing that view, but I think that is partly what he's done. Over 6 years of having the Republican Party relentlessly opposed to everything in lockstep that he wanted to do, he doesn't see there being that much upside in trying to do a deal because he just doesn't think it's going to get done and he wants to do what he thinks is right.
Again, I don't want to be someone who spends my life, my career, comparing Barack Obama to Bill Clinton. But let me do it here.
Nevertheless,
if Bill Clinton had faced these circumstances today, he would have, I think, talked about issues, maybe with not a lot of specificity, but shown some centrism by saying trade authority, nuclear power. Yeah. There's a range of things. Reforming teachers, the way teachers are treated by unions. There's all sorts of things that he could have said today to try to throw out a common agenda with the Republicans and maybe divide the Republican Party a bit. None of that.
I don't know why I didn't do it. I
mean, except for funding on Ebola and funding for ISIS. Yeah. The final war against ISIS. Well, I'm just saying, those are apple
pie. It's
both
of their interests to find common ground. It's in the Republicans' interest to prove that they can govern.
Yeah,
it's in the Democrat. It's in the president's interest because it can at least add something to his sense of legacy.
And he doesn't want to waste the last 2 years in office. He wants to get something done in these next 2 years, you presumably think.
I think there's more political pressure on Republicans not to get stuff done than some people do.
Right.
Only because by the fall, we've discussed this here, by the fall, it would take the fall to get anything major to the president's desk or even to a conference committee. By then, I think a lot of Republicans are going to say, we can get a deal with the president where we get 65-35, the president's way. Let's wait a year. There'll be a Republican president, hopefully, from their point of view. And then we can get the whole thing done. So I just think the window for them to really want to work with the president is pretty small, pretty narrow.
Is McConnell going to try to repeal health care?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
I don't think he has the stomach for it. I think there might be some attempts to fix Obamacare. There is some notion that there are. I mean, I as a matter of policy, I think it's very hard to quote fix it without having the whole thing unravel. But there are.
Want to get rid of the individual mandate, yes, which he says he wants,
yes,
to do.
I mean, but there are proposals out there that people on the right think you could try to chip away at it in various ways. You know, but so will there be some things? Will there be some symbolic votes taken? I don't think Mitch McConnell is going to send repeals after repeal. Ted Cruz wants to keep sending repeal to Barack Obama's desk and making him veto it over and over again. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. Some of these new Republican senators are very conservative.
They're very conservative, but I think if you look at their bios, and I've met some of them, but I don't know them well enough to make this judgment directly, but if you look at their bios and their careers, I think they will be more like senators who are part of trying to get things done, like a Marco Rubio, rather than like a Ted Cruz or a Mike Lee.
The best thing could happen is somehow to read where the country is, I think, mm-hmm, who's fed up. And that's what this election was about. And somehow to be motivated by that.
In my entire career, with the possible exception of 1992, I've never seen so many people, as I travel around, and I'm sure you two see it too, so many people who say Washington needs to work better. It's crazy. And it's often
gentle language from what I hear.
Yeah, but it's often just as strong from conservatives as liberals, yeah, and it's often, I think, in a very gratifying way, in a very important way, connected to very specific things. Washington needs to work better, not in the abstract, but because we have to reduce the deficit, or we have to fight ISIS.
We need new infrastructure.
You know, we need new infrastructure. Yeah, right. But we need trade. Yeah, and so that is probably the biggest reason for optimism that they can overcome some of these personal things.
Because the president wants to do something about corporate income tax. I mean, he wants to reduce it.
Boy, I just do not see tax reform at this point because there's winners and losers and lobbyists, and I just don't see this president holding that fragile coalition together on tax reform, corporate or individual or both. It happens once in a generation.
Tell me who's going to be the stars that were elected yesterday that we don't know a lot about. Is Tom Cotton one, for example?
You know, he's got a great resume. I think he still needs to broaden his communication skills to be a real star.
Who else?
Cory Gardner is a very impressive guy.
Very conservative,
but very impressive and a good communicator. And, you know, that state has produced some politicians who are comfortable fits for their state and just sort of big personalities. And I think he could be one of them.
And who moderated his stances on a lot of the, part of the reason why Udall's constant harping on a lot of the, I mean, I say that as some of his supporters felt like he was a one-note candidate talking about women's issues and the war on women and gender and reproductive rights. You know, Gardner moved to the center on those issues as part of the way in which he neutralized Udall's charges in that direction. So he's very conservative, for sure, but he's also moved in certain ways to kind of moderate
himself. Two businessmen who got elected governors in blue states, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, Bruce Rauner in Illinois. I think they both could potentially be big national stars.
How about Purdue?
Not been impressive also with his communication skills, you know, and his feel for populism.
What does this mean for the Republican race for the presidency?
Well, I'd say, look, there are three obvious things. One, Chris Christie had a really big night. And you know, he's
campaigning in 37 states.
He won a bunch of races. We pointed out he won governorships in blue states like Massachusetts and Maryland. He held on to the governorships that he really needed to hold on to, like Florida and in Wisconsin. He will be able to say that he was a very successful RGA chairman at a time when he was very distracted by the Bridgegate investigations, and he still will have had a very successful tenure in that regard. So that's a big deal. It's a big deal with donors. It's a big deal within the party. It's a big deal in terms of collecting chits around the country. John Kasich, who won re-election in October in Ohio by 31 points, 68-37 in that race, is someone who's thinking about running, and I think, you know, now is a pretty big credential. And then Scott Walker, you know, if he had not survived his re-election effort, he would have been done for, and I think he will look at it.
Is the Republican Party more conservative as a result of this election or more moderate?
More moderate, for sure.
Yeah.
Because of the need to govern now that they have both chambers. And because, again, I think most of the people who were elected in the Senate, and a lot of these governors who were elected are people who want to get things done and are not bomb throwers.
And not just that. I mean, this was a race where the Republicans and Democrats alike agree about one thing, which is that the key element of Republicans' victories last night was that they had great candidate selection and that in their primaries, the establishment candidates won. And that was because the party establishment rallied around them. They saw what happened in 2010 with a bunch of candidates like Christine O'Donnell and Ken Buck and Sharon Angle, and they made sure that didn't happen again. The Tea Party candidates were almost uniformly beaten in these primaries, and these candidates were the establishment anointed candidates. And the great lesson for the Republicans is that it worked. That picking the more, they're not, again, not moderates by any means, but non-Tea Party, non-fringe candidates.
Picking people that thought had a chance to be elected.
And you've seen it in the coverage just in the last day, in the same way we've seen all this backbiting around President Obama, the Democratic Party. You've seen establishmentarian elected officials and strategists in the paper saying, using words like wackos. The wackos are now, have been purged. Right. The wackos are now back in their cages. We are now back in charge. And that kind of language tells you something about what the party establishment has taken as the lesson from last night.
Hillary Clinton.
Look, I don't want to overstate this, but I think this is very bad for her over the next few months. Her operation does some things very well. One thing it does not do well, and this applies to her, is deal with complicated and evolving situations. And what the last night's result does, because it was unexpected, it sends this off in an unpredictable trajectory for her. How does she posture towards the president now that he's even weaker? Does she have to distance herself faster? Well, how does she deal with the new Republicans in Congress? Is she someone who talks about compromising with them as president, or is she someone who talks about confronting them? And it throws off whatever calendar she was thinking of about when to announce. So I think that her operation is not nimble. They overanalyze, they overstress about everything, and now there's a lot to analyze and stress about.
When she makes a statement like corporations don't create jobs, mm-hmm. is that good or bad for her?
Oh, it's bad for her because, in that case, she tried to clean it up. She knew it was a bad thing. I mean, I'm never a big fan of these things. I think the press, allows the opposition to sort of make a big deal about it. But it shows again that she's just, even though she has days when she is a better candidate than she's given credit for, she has plenty of days when she's kind of a clunker as a presenter. And Republicans and the press will jump all over that every time.
And there's also the element of, something Mark referred to earlier, which is that one of the things that's true is that not only do the Democrats they found out that turning the midterm electorate into a presidential electorate is harder than they thought, which is to say getting more non-white voters, more young voters, more single female voters to come out. That turned out to be hard, even though they spent a lot of money trying to do it. The other thing is that the Democratic economic message did not resonate with white working class and white middle class voters. And so the party right now has some positions that are very popular, but doesn't have an economic theory. And that leaves Hillary Clinton to fashion that out of whole cloth. That's an opportunity for her, but it's also a real challenge because it's not like there's an obvious thing for her to just pick up and run with.
I don't think there was a Democratic message because they were scared to death of the relationship with the president and his policies. And they thought, therefore, they tried to be as defensive as they were and talk about local issues and education and that kind of thing. So there never was a message. But the same thing is true about the Republicans. I mean, it seems to me in this election, what you come out is everybody was against something, nobody was for something.
That's right.
And therefore, in a country in which people are saying, we have to do better.
Yeah. With the exception of Ed Gillespie in Virginia, who got very close to winning, a seat he wasn't expected to win, who had a health care plan to say this is the alternative, I looked at every major Senate candidate. They had nothing on the economy, nothing on jobs, nothing on education, an original idea. And that's why I think in the presidential contest, this applies to Hillary Clinton and all the Republicans who might run. The field is wide open. Come up with two ideas that you can connect to the real lives of real people. You will lap the field.
And this, and you again, tomorrow I might make this point about Bill Clinton, but you think back in 1992 when, the basis of Clinton's run then was going around and giving the series of big policy speeches that were about his theory of the case. Right. The stage is now yours, guys, Republicans and Democrats alike. Neither party has a theory of the case. It's now, the floor is yours. Right. You guys have a huge opportunity to do what Clinton did. And we'll see if anybody wants to occupy that stage and grab the mic.
And the people who are given most credit now for being big idea people, Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, you read their policy speeches, they're not wholly unthoughtful, but the notion that embedded in them is some idea that will capture the public imagination.
It's too much political rhetoric in both of them.
That's right.
And disconnected, just like, interesting little shards of ideas, but not a fully integrated case. Not a fully integrated
argument.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Back in a moment. Stay with us. Nightcrawler is a new movie by Dan Gilroy. It follows a videographer who sells graphic footage to a local news station in Los Angeles. And Hornaday of the Washington Post calls the movie a modern-day media allegory. Here is the trailer for Nightcrawler.
Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for a job. I'm a hard worker. I set high goals. My motto is, if you want to win the lottery, you have to make the money to buy a ticket. So what do you say? I could start tomorrow, or even why not tonight?
No, I'm not hiring.
We're first. Go around. Get a shot inside the car.
Hey, back away.
I got it. I'm back.
Will this be on television?
Morning news. If it bleeds, it leads.
Are you currently hiring? I'm starting a TV news business.
You, get back.
I film breaking stories. Maybe you saw my item this morning with fatal carjacking.
No, I mean, I don't have a TV.
Do you have a cell phone?
Yeah.
Is that GPS?
Yeah.
Congratulations, you're hired.
Okay.
We're taking the next right.
That's stupid!
They beat the police.
I will never ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do myself. Excuse me. I have something you'll be very excited about.
You have a good eye. I want you to contact me when you have something.
Something like this.
Think of our newscast as a screaming woman running down the street with her throat cut.
You will be seeing me again.
Any unit, residential 211.
A home invasion. And we will, at the right time. But I don't know what to. We're gonna find the person that drove that car.
Start filming.
I'm Detective Fonieri.
I think you withheld information.
That would be a very unprofessional thing for me to do.
It would be murder.
I want what you promised me. I want something people can't turn away from.
911, what's your emergency?
I think Lou is inspiring all of us to reach a little higher.
Joining me is Dan Gilroy, the director and screenwriter, and Jake Gyllenhaal, the film star. I'm pleased to have them at this table. Welcome. I think what we just saw, the trailer answers this, but what is a Nightcrawler?
Nightcrawler is a euphemism for a stringer.
Yeah, which right, is exactly. In a print term.
Yeah, the cameramen who go and film non-union at night when the union cameramen are asleep and try and find footage to sell to local news.
And it's pretty easy to sell if, in fact, they don't have anybody on the case.
Yes, or if it's gory enough. As Dan's script says, you know, they're not interested in all crime. They're interested in crime creeping into the suburbs, you know. So right. It isn't as easy to get, you know, good footage. But when you get it, it's worth something.
Where did the idea come from?
Oh, the idea originally came when I heard about Ouija, the crime photographer from the 1930s.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
They made a film about
him.
Joe Pesci made a film called Public Eye.
Right,
got there
right,
first.
Right,
and when I moved to Los Angeles, I heard about, I guess, what would be considered the modern equivalent. These people who go out with video cameras instead of the speed graphics. And they have a dozen scanners instead of one. And I just thought it was a very kinetic backdrop for a film.
You said you envision Lou Bloom as a coyote.
Dan and I talked a lot about when we first started working on the film about the topography of Los Angeles and about how, you know, there are the mountain ranges, but essentially outside this massive metropolis from, you know, from space, if you were to look at it from there, there's just blackness, the desert, there's the wild desert and the animals that come down from the mountain ranges and from the desert sort of into the metropolis at night, scrounging and hunting for food. And, you know, Lou really was that. He was sort of like a walking metaphor for a generation that, you know, was looking for jobs, looking for work, but also at the same time really primal, and his intention was to succeed, and he was hungry literally and figuratively like a coyote. Right. So we just decided, you know, it'd be interesting if he looked like that.
Now, his eyes are important in this film.
Well, they became important because when Jake made this very bold decision to lose the weight, one, to get a physical appearance like a coyote, but two, there's, like Jake talked about, there's a desperation to the character, there's a hunger, and yes,
as he's talking, a
survival, very much a survival, because I think we're in an increasingly survival-oriented world, but his eyes became more prominent, and an energy came out that I think is very effective in the film, in which the character feels he wants to consume not just food, but ideas and people and whatever's in front of him.
All right, take a look at this. This is where Jake Lew Bloom tells the TV news editor, Renee Russo, by the way, your wife, by the way, what he wants Nightcrawler wants. Roll tape.
The name of my company is Video Production News, a professional news gathering service. That's how it should be read, and that's how it should be said. I also want to go to the next rung and meet your team and the station manager and the director and the anchors and start developing my own personal relationships. I'd like to start meeting them this morning. You'll take me around. You'll introduce me as the owner and president of Video Production News and remind them of some of my many other stories. I'm not done. I also want to stop our discussion over prices. This will save time. So when I say that a particular number is my lowest price, that's my lowest price. And you can be assured that I arrived at whatever that number is very carefully. Now, when I say that I want these things, I mean that I want them. And I don't want to have to ask again.
So tell me about that scene. I mean, I like the scene, but tell me.
Well, you're watching, in terms of the, where you are in the story, you're watching the full blossoming of an autodidactic, self-actualized person who's come into a landscape of pure hyper-competitive free market, and it turns out every instinct he has is well-suited for it. He is utterly empowered in the scene he is now. He's saying that to Renee Russo. She's actually the news director of the station that he sells the footage to, and heretofore she has really been holding most of the cards. And you are now realizing that
he has power, that
he is the one who has the power.
Why did you want to do the part?
It was the best screenplay I've ever read, to be honest.
The best you'd ever read.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It was a character unlike anything I had ever read. His dialogue is extraordinary. He has these huge, long soliloquies, as you can see. Right. But that's just the first.
Should we be concerned about the world that you have shown us here?
Well, I would be concerned on a number of levels. One, we present this character as a success story to some degree.
Yeah.
And it's a personal film for me, and I think for Jake and other people who came involved, because I think I feel certainly that the lose of the world, people who have sociopathic tendencies, are increasingly being rewarded, on that level, I think we should be concerned. On another level, local television news, depending on the market, does tend very heavily toward graphic, violent images, particularly in Los Angeles, and it creates an ethos of fear that we all walk around in, and unless you can parse it, and unless you can look at other outlets and perhaps get a more nuanced narrative of what's going on, you could walk around believing that crime is going down in Los Angeles. Crime is going up. In fact, it's going down. That somebody wanders into your neighborhood who you don't know should be perceived as a threat, when in fact they're just going off to get a slushie. And I think there's a societal toll to local television news and network news that leans into fear to get ratings, is something that has a detrimental effect that I don't feel we can really put our finger on. But I think I think it's something that we should be aware of.
I mean, two things have been apparent to me in watching and being a part of morning television. Not so much what we do, but at the same time, we cover these subjects. One is weather, and the other is crime. Mm. You know?
I mean, right.
The crime and natural disasters.
Well, I'll go back to Los Angeles television market for a minute. The weather girls in Los Angeles are becoming sort of like pinup dolls, just because weather and sex somehow is something that draws ratings in.
To quote his script, Renee Russo's character says to one of the other people working the station, she says, your job is getting Heather, what's her
Deb,
name? Deb to turn sideways and to get the quote of the tweet of the day, right? That's what he said.
And so that's weather. And in terms of crime, again, they're trying to get ratings. People compare this film sometimes to Network because it's about journalism.
Right.
And I thought what Patty Chayefsky captured so well was the moment when network news departments were told they had to make a profit. Because there was a time, as we remember, when news departments were sacrosanct and they were providing a service that went beyond entertainment. And the second news departments have to make a profit, they start to drift into entertainment. Because Renee plays a news director, news directors are at every station, and they have an imperative. They have to bring ratings up.
If you talk to David Fincher, he will tell you Gone Girl isn't part about the media.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And Ben Affleck, you know, because it's the obsessiveness of media to play off of celebrity and
create a story that survives news cycles.
Yeah. Well, I think the difference between a movie like Gone Girl and a movie like this is that this movie is begging the question of how we are all complicit in that situation. It's easy to put blame on the media, and I think that's a sort of simplification of it. I think it's more, you know, in the character in the movie, Lou, is enabled by Renee Russo's character, who buys the footage, who's enabled by the station heads, who's inevitably enabled by the audience.
Right.
And I think that we are the audience. And how are we complicit is what, how do we create somebody like Lou is what this movie's asking. And I think that's what's interesting. Dan sort of takes it a step further. Instead of just saying, oh, look what the media does, he says, how did we create this?
This is the clip where Lou first introduces himself to Nina. Old tape.
You my fill-in operator?
I don't think so. I'm Lou Bloom. I have some footage for sale.
A stringer?
What?
Who do you work for?
At the moment, I work for myself.
Okay, we'll see Frank out there the way you came. What's the time to?
1:06.
What do you have?
Something I'm fairly certain you'll be very excited about.
His first sale.
That's his first sale.
That's his first sale, yeah. Yeah. Turns out he's learning a lot.
He's a remarkable salesman, too, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
He's confident, he's on the point, he's...
Well, he has sociopathic tendencies, and he's extraordinarily smart. He's brilliant. And he understands. There's a line in the film where somebody says, you know, your problem is you don't understand people. And there's an irony there because he understands people the way the lion understands the gazelle. He knows everything about people.
The interesting thing about you is that some would argue that this is a role that you couldn't have played 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, that A, it's because of your growth as an actor, because of a whole lot of other things. Do you buy that, or you think, look, I could have done this 5 years ago. I just didn't have the opportunity to do it 5 years ago.
No. I don't think so. I don't think I could have done it 5 years ago, particularly just because of the technique, the discipline that I've learned. One of the main things I feel like I approach my work with is this one idea, which is that freedom is on the other side of discipline.
I agree totally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a great quote.
And to me, that's what I've sort of nurtured and cultivated over the past 5 years, is this idea that preparation is everything.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Preparation is on the other side of discipline.
Right. I mean, it really is. You know, and
freedom is on the other side of preparation.
And I don't have the ability to do something in the moment just like that. I have to do that preparation. And the preparation is my favorite part. That's what I've learned. Yes, it's my favorite part.
Just learning who the character is and figuring out how you're going
to... Yes. Everything having to do with real life connected to a character is more fun. It was more fun for me going on the streets with Dan at night with the stringers. It was more fun talking with Dan about all of the idiosyncrasies of this character, trying to collect ideas, walking down the street, taking a picture of someone's tie, thinking that Lou should wear that tie. All of that time, which was very intimate, was most fun for me. The performance is terrifying in a way and really fun, but not as much fun as the preparation. And talking about it, though I'm an actor and it would seem that I would love to do that, is less interesting.
Yeah. Well, in preparation, you have infinite possibilities.
But you know what I mean?
You have infinite possibilities in preparation. When you're actually doing it, everything becomes finite and you feel like, oh my God, it's actually being set in cement right now and I have to move on. And
it's still at the same time. I mean, I feel the same way about preparation for this television show. You know, but at the same time, it all comes together on the moment that you come to the table.
You have to let it all go. But you have to believe in the unconscious.
You have to let it all go. You're absolutely right.
Well, the unconscious will guide you there. You know what I mean?
If you're prepared.
Yeah.
If you've done the preparation. I mean,
the best person, people who really understand this are jazz musicians.
Yeah. You
know, they know that they got to be good musicians before they have the freedom to go off and riff.
Well, that's funny because the words in this movie, the structure of these speeches or this dialogue, and some of it is truly extraordinary. You know, within that, the intentions were like jazz. We changed the intentions of almost every scene, take to take. Right. You know, I would take one, I'd do one take, and it would be completely different from the next because the words allowed that. You know, the melody sort of was the melody. We had the structure of what that was, but within inside that, we danced like
crazy. We were very close creatively, and we collaborated, and it was always an exploration, preparation, and on the set.
Maggie was here. God, I love her.
Me too.
She's great in that film. I mean, she's on Broadway, which I haven't seen. But
yeah, she's extraordinary in that, too.
Is it Stoppard she's doing?
She's doing The Real Thing, yeah. On Broadway. Oh, but she's amazing in The Honorable Woman, too,
God,
the television show.
I loved the
film.
I loved her in it. I loved her.
She's really, I mean, I told her this the other night when I saw her in her show. I think she's really mastered something. I mean, I don't think it's possible to master totally the craft of acting, but my sister has really mastered something in her work that is so moving to me to watch, not only as her brother, but also as a fellow artist and a fellow actor. It's, you know, to watch her up on stage, she's so agile. Her mind is so extraordinary. It's just, it's testament to the mind when you see an actor up there. You know, that you can see how they work in a way that you can't normally in movies because obviously someone else's hands changing things. But up on that stage, there's a purity. And she has really mastered something. It's amazing to watch her. She's extraordinary.
Well,
I mean, she's my older sister, so I feel that way. But
right. Well, she isn't.
Well said. Great to meet you.
Nice talking to you.
Renee as well.
Thank you.
Back in a moment. Stay with us.
a business pro, maestro of project management, baron of the build-out. You need a permit to be this awesome. And you rent from National, because only National lets you choose any car in the aisle and go. You can even take a full size or above and still pay the mid-size price.
Perfect.
Meow, business pro. Meow. Go National. Go like a pro.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
Dina Varshavskaya is here. She is founder and CEO of Wanilo. It is changing how we shop. The online social media app connects millions of consumers with some of the biggest brands, as well as the tiniest of independent boutiques. Over 20 million products from more than 350,000 stores are made available to her company's more than 11 million active users. I'm pleased to have her here at this table for the first time. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Let me talk about you. And before we talk about the company, born in
Siberia.
In Siberia. Your father was a journalist.
Correct.
Yeah. And your parents divorced.
Also correct.
And you came to America.
Yes.
With your father and his family.
Correct.
Yeah. Settled in New Jersey first.
Yes. Yeah. For a short amount of time. Yeah. Just a couple of years.
And then?
Moved to upstate New York for college, Cornell. Yeah.
Cornell.
Studied everything under the sun, looking for my passion. I knew from an early age that I was had no interest in having a regular 9-to-5. So
right.
was definitely scared of that.
But was there any entrepreneurial, you know, experience, any reason to know that what you would like to do is build a business?
Not yet. No. It took until after I left college to actually discover that the real world had problems, which I was really interested in solving.
In terms of finding the right products they wanted for their own pleasure.
So entrepreneurs are just optimizers.
Yeah.
You know, we just walk around kind of scanning the environment for what is the thing that needs to be improved.
Yeah.
And so as soon as I found that first thing and I said, I know how to do this better,
that
became a passion.
I can build a better mousetrap.
Yeah.
That idea. But you left Cornell, a very good university, only two courses short of graduation. I mean, some people say, why couldn't you just go ahead and finish and graduate and take those two courses? Were you so anxious to do something, or was there something else?
I think it has
Fess
to do
up.
With... Yeah, yeah. No, it's an interesting question for sure. I think what happened is that I actually was disagreeing with the way traditional education was handling, you know, me as a person. And I felt that I wanted to sink my teeth into something, and academia just wasn't it.
And how long did it take you to find your present Wanilo?
It took several years, probably five or so.
But you were entrepreneurial in terms of looking at online things that you might do.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So after I left Cornell, I had actually gotten exposed to what the startup world is about, right? So I started noticing that, you know, there was all this storytelling about startup founders and startups that are just building huge things. And frankly, that just sounded really fun. So I started kind of taking on this notion that, you know what, I think that seems like something I'd want to do. I'd want to build a company and run it.
So Wanilo stands for who needs love?
Want, need, love.
Yeah.
The first
and how did
two
you come
letters
up with
of those
that?
Three words. So it came from a personal frustration first. So just going to the malls and, you know, I've always had unique taste and I really care about my style and the things that I put in my house. And so I'd go shopping and I'd be looking for that special unique pair of shoes. And traditional malls were just really frustrating. Limited choice, you know, kind of predictable. And so I started thinking, you know, where are all the independent stores that are out there, the designers that are out there? How do I find out about them? And so that was piece one. And the second piece was actually just thinking about the future of shopping and discovery of products and stores, you know. So, I mean, so basically, social networking is something that is just taken over, right? If we kind of go back to the beginning of our thesis, humans have always been social, but it's only recently that it's become possible to actually create massive networks, global networks of of humans, right? So
you can unite people of shared passion, shared curiosity, shared
in ways that were completely impossible before. And so that's why we have platforms like Twitter and Pinterest and Instagram.
What's
and Facebook.
Interesting about that is you put yourself right there alongside those very successful platforms.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, it just speaks to the ambition of play.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that
your company's value, I would assume, valuating hundreds of millions. Is it that? How much is it valued? Is it hard to tell because you're not
public? The last official valuation that is released was over 100 million.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yes. And you do that in terms of what the people who invest in you, you know, what they pay for percentage of the business, I assume.
Correct.
Right. So, and therefore, you put yourself in the category with Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and others. Do you worry that they become competition for you because they have a family that might be in search of the same thing? Or do you have, as Warren Buffett says, you must have a moat around your own business so that you're protected?
You must have a moat. So the reason I don't worry about these particular social platforms is that people don't actually go to Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram, Facebook to shop. That's number one.
But why wouldn't they, though? I mean, I know you say that, and you say they go to Twitter for news, they go, you know, to others for different kinds, they go to...
I think it's just how the human mind works, and that we like to have a single category, and we like to have sort of you know, a business or a thing that owns that category, right? So, I mean, you don't go to Amazon to read news. Why? Because Amazon owns commodity shopping for you, quick, convenience shopping. So you don't go to Twitter to shop.
Yeah, but in fact, what's happening, and I'm asking this.
Yes, please.
They're all getting in each other's business. I mean, Amazon and Google, Apple. They all compete, Facebook. They're competing with each other.
Because they're competing for attention.
Exactly. But why wouldn't they decide, we can do what she does, and we have, you have a millions of users. But why wouldn't they say, we can do this with her, and we can compete, and why not?
They do, in fact, work on commerce. And in media, we have a lot of conversation about, you know, Facebook commerce and Twitter commerce and Pinterest commerce. But the truth of the matter, so your intent is number one. That's the first reason why I believe you don't go to, you know, you don't go to these platforms to shop. Number two is that something that people underestimate is that shopping actually has a really unique set of problems that need to be solved in order for it to work. And I think it's not an accident that, you know, as we look at these social networks, we have a leading social network for almost every important human need. And shopping kind of continues to be, you know, the one lagging. And I think the reason why that is the case is that it's just how hard those problems are. When you're dealing with an image versus a product is a lot more complex as an entity because it has availability, it has pricing, it has sizes, colors available with it, right? So on Wanilo, we have to know whether this product is even still available so that we can show it to you. So that's that problem is really, really challenging.
Profile a person who comes to Wanilo.
U.S., female, college age.
What do they come with? A question? Do they come with a picture?
So they typically come to see what's greatest and what's latest. They come to be inspired, to find, you know, what's trending. They come to see the latest, greatest products. And it's really fun for them, right? So there's a utility component to it where they like finding things that are, you know, to buy. But it's also just, it's very entertaining for them. They love this experience.
And then you direct them to the site.
We do.
Of whoever makes that item.
Correct.
And whoever has that site, if they sell, they pay you a percentage of the cost of the item?
That's correct.
Sounds like a business to me.
Yes, we are the only social network where all of our content is 100% purchasable.
Yes. Good point.
Quite like that. And what that means for us is that our business model can be 100% aligned with what our users need. Right? So we don't need to interrupt our users with advertising, for example.
From 2013 to 2014, you went from 1 million users to 10 million users. You know? Is that a growth rate that you can continue? I mean, can you grow it that fast from 2014 to 2015, 2015 to 2016? Because growth becomes exponential. It's like stone rolling down the mountain.
Growth is something you have to master as a discipline. It's a challenging question.
Yeah. How do you master it?
I think for us it's about understanding what is the utility around what we're building. And as I mentioned to you earlier, I think we're solving incredibly challenging problems. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, we've done a lot of research with women in their 30s. And we know that women in their 30s, as compared to younger women, like women in their 20s, have a lot less patience. Mm-hmm. They're a lot more experienced as shoppers. They have a lot more preferences. You know, they know which brands they like already. Right. And so a lot of what we do internally is we spend time thinking, what does that mean? How do we develop the platform for them?
You might think that they would have, for example, they might say, why would I go to Juanilo, who's going to direct me to Ralph Lauren? Why don't I go just directly to Ralph Lauren?
That's correct. Assuming that you already know Ralph Lauren, right, and that is a brand you like, that's exactly the experience you have. Yeah. And so one of the things that's different about Juanilo is that you will be exposed to lots of independent brands, lots of low-end, high-end brands that you just would have never found on your own. So yes, it works for, I have five brands that I like to go to. But it will expose you to things that you would have never found otherwise. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other benefit is that it brings all of the brands together for you in a single place.
Is any risk for you in this?
Risk?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
In other words, if they don't like the product, it's not your fault. It's the fault of the company that sold it to them. You just got a transactional fee for connecting two people, buyer and a seller.
We take on some responsibility for connecting, for sure.
You do.
And there's choices for us to be made in terms of how centralized of a platform we want to be and how much responsibility do we take. And I think that's something we'll have to learn a lot about as we continue. Absolutely. I mean, we have people emailing us all the time. They don't even necessarily know that they've placed the purchase with a brand. They think that they've already purchased on Juanilo.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So they see it on your Juanilo and then send their credit card in and...
And one of the reasons why this happens is that this, a lot of our usage is actually on mobile. So the majority of our usage is on mobile. Mm-hmm. And on mobile, if you try the experience, you'll see that, it's a very fragmented experience of going from the product page that you find a product you like, going to the retailer. It's frequently hard to tell on your phone, whether you're on Juanilo or a store page. So it's understandable that people mix it up.
And what percentage of people use mobile to shop with you?
For us, it's between 85 and 90%.
That's where the world's going, isn't it?
It is.
Or is there.
It's.
And Facebook shows that people can advertise on mobile.
I mean, mobile is absolutely transformative. Yeah. And it's interesting, for shopping, there's certainly a lot more to prove. So currently, the smartphone is a really common starting place for your research.
Right.
So the stats are that 55% of all shopping research actually starts on your phone. But then only 7% gets completed as a purchase.
See, I get that. But my question is, most people have a laptop of some kind, don't they?
Yes.
But they don't even use that. They go for mobile. Is mobile easier? What does mobile have that your laptop doesn't have or your iPad doesn't have?
It's always with you.
Okay, fine. So that's the convenience of being with you. So you can shop wherever you are.
Right. It means that, for millennials, they wake up with a phone. It's the first thing they do, right? Yeah. I'm in that group. No. I'm lying on my pillow and I look at my phone. It is the first thing that happens. There you go.
You too?
Of course.
It's the first thing you do.
Of course. And that's where the excitement is.
But you're looking for different things. I'm looking at news. I'm saying, what happened overnight?
Yes.
That's the reason I first look at it.
Makes sense.
And you're doing what? What are you looking for?
I look at my email. I look at my email, course, to see what happened in my email. Yeah. And then I go through social networks. I go through news.
You went looking for venture capital. And the first 40 people, VCs that you saw, said, you're a very nice person, but no thank you. Correct?
That's almost correct. Right. They actually try to avoid saying no.
Oh, they do.
It's not in their interest to outright reject you, but yes, I got 40. They'll push
the
things.
The timing's not right, or
later,
you're on a list, or we'll get to
send us more information, things like that.
Right.
Yes, but I got 40 rejections.
Yeah. And then finally, why did it take so long? And B, finally, the person or the company that broke through, was they any different in your presentation? Did they respond differently? What was that made that experience successful?
So the reason it was so challenging was that I didn't fit the pattern.
Right.
I'm not your typical Silicon Valley. Yeah, you know,
you didn't come out of business school. You didn't.
Dude in a sweatshirt.
Right,
that I'm not.
Right, you're not a dude in a sweatshirt.
I also
didn't have a hoodie.
That's right. I also didn't have a technical team at the time.
Right.
So there were legitimate reasons for why, you know, it was challenging for me to raise. And then
so
what happened is...
So you knew what you wanted to do, but you didn't know how to do it.
At the time when I started raising funding, I had already built an early prototype, if you will, of the website. And we actually had an early community.
You paid somebody to build it for you.
Correct.
Right.
And then we actually had an early community that was organically growing.
Right.
And that's what ultimately helped the investors and start closing my funding. I would just send them updates.
Do you love this?
I absolutely do. I think it's completely intense and crazy and insane.
Yeah.
But if I weren't doing what I'm doing, I probably would be really bored. So it's my only option.
Can you imagine what you'd be doing if you weren't doing this?
Probably something equally crazier. Crazy.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Aren't always obvious. Sometimes they just drop in. CME Group can help you navigate risks and capture opportunities. We enable you to reach global markets and drive forward with broader possibilities. CME Group, how the world advances.
$15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Everybody knows that.
Well, did you know genies can be really literal?
No.
What is your wish?
No.
Okay.
$1 million.
Oh, no.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
I think that the Malaysian government creates a very business-friendly environment. They've been working alongside us throughout the 40 over years. We wouldn't be where we are today without that support. And obviously, that support would continue.
Malaysia is at the forefront of success. We have very talented people, world-class infrastructure, and we provide a very strategic environment for businesses to grow.
Start your day so you make better investment decisions.
You watch Bloomberg Surveillance to find out what the markets are doing. And you talk to smart people. Bloomberg Surveillance, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
Trade King, an online stock and options broker trusted by over 500,000 clients. $4.95 per stock trade. Streaming data. Free tools and research. Online education center. Mobile apps. Are you ready for a new breed of broker? Switch to Trade King. Get $1,000 in free trade commissions by going to TradeKing.com/free1000 today. TradeKing.com.
What does Silicon Valley get that other industries don't yet?
Bloomberg's Emily Chang sits down with the biggest influencers in technology and media.
Honestly, in the beginning, we were not trying to make money.
It was all an experiment. You think that you may live to 120.
I certainly hope to, yes.
I'm a little paranoid of not being needed and wanted, I guess.
For candid conversations about how they made it and where they're going next, Studio 1.0. This week, Aaron Sorkin. Tonight at 8:30 on Bloomberg Television.
You are a business pro. Solver of the slice. Teacher of the unteachable. You lower handicaps and raise hopes. And you rent from National, because only National lets you choose any car in the aisle and go. You can even take a full size or above and still pay the mid-size price.
Nice drive.
Well played, business pro. Well played. Go National. Go like a pro.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
I'm Mark Halperin.
And I'm John Heilman. And with all due respect to Alex Rodriguez, we may be hopped up on performance enhancers, but there ain't no roid rage up in here. Abari, sports fans. In our lineup tonight, the right wing is not all right, GOP voters are not all white, and the Republicans who might run for president are taking flight. But first, on day two of the great reddening of America, our elected Republican leaders are showing that they're more in sync than Justin Timberlake and Joey Fatone. Yesterday it was Mitch McConnell, and today it was John Boehner's turn to fall in line. Two leaders, one script, take a look.
I believe that the president continues to act on his own. He is going to poison the well.
The president choosing to do a lot of things unilaterally on immigration would be a big mistake.
When you play with matches, you take the risk of burning yourself. And he's going to burn himself.
It's like waving a red flag in front of a bull to say, if you guys don't do what I want, I'm going to do it on my own.
The American people made it clear election day. They want to get things done.
The American people have changed the Senate. So I think we have an obligation to change the behavior of the Senate and to begin to function again.
All right, Mark, so the big question here, can Boehner and McConnell remain as joined at the hip in the future as they did today?
This is a big turtle on a fence post moment. My suspicion is that these guys have been strategizing for a while. Joint op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today on message, poll tested and smart. They're not talking about social issues. They're not talking about issues that divide the Republican Party. They're talking about accountability. They're talking about issues like not on immigration, on issues like the economy. They're being very smart and disciplined. They're not being angry. They're not going to impeach the president. They're not going to fail to raise the debt ceiling. Right now, this is a smart inside game and a surprisingly smart outside game from these two guys.
It's been impressive. It's only 24 hours early, and so it's early days. You know, McConnell, I think, has the easier task. He's got a few rabble-rousers. I don't think many of these incoming senators are going to be problematic for him. Ted Cruz will be a thorn in his side going forward, but he can manage his caucus pretty well. Down the road, the question is Boehner. And that Republican caucus, that Tea Party caucus in the House, which is still quite large and still quite fractious, you know, on something like immigration, the problem's not going to be on McConnell's side. The problem's going to be on Boehner's side and whether Boehner can work his will over there and stay with McConnell on message and on substance.
You've heard no talk of orphanages.
No.
You've heard no. You've not heard from some of the more excitable and far-right members of the Republican conference in either body with any way that's distracted from their message. This is a very big moment for the party, and so far, they're handling it really well.
So far, two key words, though.
All right, so while the congressional Republicans have been vocalizing, as we just discussed, in perfect harmony, the right-wing opinion meisters since Tuesday have been singing from a different score that sounds more like outtakes from Metal Machine music.
The Republican Party was not elected to compromise. The Republican Party was not elected to sit down and work together.
They just surrendered the power of the purse to Barack Obama. I told you the other day. They are working behind the scenes on a budget with the administration. They're going to say this demonstrates bipartisanship and that they can govern. But you're screwed.
I think it could get ugly. I think we're in the most dangerous period now than the Republic has been in since the Civil War.
It is very simple what that mandate is. It is to stop Barack Obama. It is to stop the Democrat Party. There is no other reason why Republicans were elected yesterday.
If they don't do their job and put out a competing agenda, they're going to lose in 2016. They have work to do.
I agree, and I would tell right-wingers, stay paranoid.
Those people have no incentive to have compromise with the president. Quite the contrary.
No. Barack Obama has been good for business for them.
The history of the Republican Party of late has been defined by congressional leaders being afraid of talk radio and Fox. Will the establishment, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner first and foremost, be able to withstand the pressure from that kind of cacophony, which will only build as compromise with the president comes?
Well, I'm a big fan of history, as you know, and I can't find any evidence in the historical record to suggest that they will or can. These guys, collectively, individually and collectively, have been the biggest and one of the most pernicious forces in our politics for a long time. And there's some counterparts of theirs on the left, but they are a very, very loud voice. And they have repeatedly over the last 20 years, and in only growing strength, they have put pressure on, destructive pressure on, Republican leaders and establishmentarians who want to get things done. The pressure has been intense, and they have almost always capitulated. The leaders, that is, not these guys.
Boehner and McConnell, as much as Dick Cheney, is not afraid of the flying monkeys. They're not. And they have disdain for them privately. They say it all the time to people. And when McConnell yesterday said, we're not going to have a debt ceiling crisis, we're not going to have government shutdowns, that sent a loud message. These guys and gals can attack Boehner and McConnell all they want. I don't think that they personally will be intimidated by it. Well, question is, will people pressure them?
Oh, there's no doubt. Look, I don't mean personally. I don't think that either one of them is intimidated personally. And I think McConnell, as I said, kind of relates to the first topic. I think McConnell can probably manage it within his caucus. Boehner has, though he has no respect for them personally, is not intimidated personally, he has not been very good at managing the elements in his caucus that are really afraid of those guys and are really motivated by what those guys say. That is going to be a huge test going forward, because those members of his caucus who do listen to these guys and worry about the voters who listen to these guys have been a bad force in the Republican House, and Boehner has not been great at dealing with them in the past. All right. It is the most wonderful time of the year if you're a Republican who wants to run for president. That is Chris Christie, Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Ben Carson, yes, even Ben Carson. Take a look at this video promoting a Ben Carson documentary, a forthcoming documentary. I want to make it clear to all our viewers, we did not add the soundtrack to this video.
Thing.
Yes, putting aside all the obvious jokes about flatlining, the question is, which of these potential 2016 presidential candidates is most shrewdly taking advantage of this post-midterm moment?
I think two people have done the best for themselves so far.
Yeah.
Again, it's early, but the momentum matters now. One is Chris Christie, who reportedly is already meeting with his donors and figuring out how to take that victory lap for his RGA successes. so key, because I think Chris Christie can be surprisingly strong. If Jeb Bush either hesitates about getting in or doesn't get in, correct, I think Chris Christie could be the guy who raises tens of millions of dollars quickly. The other one's Rand Paul, because he's continued with a little some social media work to be the main candidate saying, in being in the face of Hillary Clinton. And a lot of Republicans want somebody, first and foremost, who will take her on. He's been aggressive about that so far. So I'd say those two guys. So
yeah, and I'd say that Paul in that case, I agree with you about Rand Paul. I mean, Christie, you know, doing a lot of behind-the-scenes work, meeting with donors, doing all kinds of stuff. He's obviously capitalizing in a kind of relatively low-key way, which is strange for Chris Christie. But Rand Paul is really this mixture, and I think both of us agree he's probably not going to be the Republican nominee. But the combination of him talking about expanding the Republican coalition, reaching out to groups that Republicans haven't traditionally appealed to, he's been doing that a lot in the last couple days. He's also, at the same time, as you said, got twinned with that is this anti-Hillary Clinton, very sharp. And that is also resonating throughout the party. In a weird way, this is the place where Rand Paul is kind of leading the way. The party right now is going after Hillary Clinton. The Obama agenda is the Clinton agenda. And Paul sounds like, to a lot of people in the business and outside the business, like he's leading that chorus. That's a good place for him to be
right now. The person we haven't heard from is Hillary Clinton.
Right.
It's going to be interesting because Republicans are making a big deal about she campaigned for a lot of people who lost, as did every Democrat.
Yeah.
But the question is,
a lot of Democrats
when
lost.
She comes
very
out,
few won.
She's going to have to enunciate, as President Obama did yesterday, what's her lessons learned publicly from the midterms. It's going to be interesting to see now that she's not out there campaigning for people. All right. So in our ritualistic post-midterm, post-mortem, we all go through that. We found something we think is rather extraordinary in the exit polls. In some of these races, non-white voters gave substantial chunks of their support to some Republican candidates. Two examples we want to talk about. First, in Ohio, John Kasich was running for election as governor there. He got 26% of the African-American vote, according to the exit poll, up from 8% 4 years ago, and that's no accident. We'll talk about why. In Texas, Greg Abbott, who was a Republican nominee, got 44% of the Hispanic vote. That compares to Rick Perry, who got 38% of the Hispanic vote when he was the gubernatorial nominee 4 years ago. And this comes after Democratic forces from Obama world this year made a very strong push in Texas to help win more support from Latino voters. So, John, those are two examples, pretty key ones, from important states. What does that tell you, if anything, about the prospects Republicans have of winning the White House in 2016?
Well, not that much. These are kind of unique cases. But, you know, first of all, look, I mean, John Kasich has shown to people, and you can look at Mitch Daniels in Indiana 4 years ago, did the same thing. I believe Mitch Daniels had more than a third of African-American voters in Indiana. In those big Midwestern states, if you're a Republican governor who departs from right-wing orthodoxy and some of the more right extreme positions, and you have social programs, and you reach out to communities of African-Americans, you can be popular. Daniels did it. Kasich's done it now. Down in Texas, you've got a case where Wendy Davis, who became the poster girl for kind of abortion on demand, that is not a great message for Hispanics, who are quite culturally conservative. Even if they like Democrats more on immigration, they don't like the far-left cultural posturing, and Abbott, like Perry, previously capitalized on that there.
The Democratic Party has a lot of thinking about for 2016 about what a post-Obama Democratic Party is. Those numbers are really cautionary. I think they're a big deal because it shows that Democrats do not have a hold on these constituencies. All right, coming up, our thesaurus, it turns out, is kind of naked. We're running out of words to describe what happened to the Democrats on Tuesday. So we've asked Dan Pfeiffer of the White House to brainstorm with us a little bit. We'll do that with Dan Pfeiffer live right after this.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Koch Industries. Learn more at KochCareers.com.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
A remote that lives on your phone. More Wi-Fi in more places. A movie library you can take wherever you go. Internet speeds that have gotten faster 13 times in 12 years. At Comcast, we're creating new possibilities. Together with Time Warner Cable, we'll be able to extend those to more people. Comcast and Time Warner Cable. Together is better for more people.
I state your name.
I, Ron Swartz.
Do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Television has the interviews you want to hear.
One of the fascinating things about Twitter is that once you get it, it becomes indispensable to you.
My eyes were all created equal.
Online, on your tablet, and on your phone. Bloomberg Television, wherever you are.
We think that our guest tonight may, just may, be looking to get out of the White House sooner rather than later. But we're happy to take advantage of the fact that he is still there. Dan Pfeiffer, there he is. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You guys are famous in that White House back in 2012 for having little parlor games, ranking the moments of using Gallo humors to rank the lowest moments, the darkest moments of the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. Where does this moment right now rank on that low moments for you guys?
Well, I don't know if I can give it a specific ranking, but it's pretty high up on the list. I'll be honest about that.
Okay.
It's high because...
Top 10,
low.
Top 5?
I'd put it in the top 10 for sure.
Okay.
Right. Better or worse than when the BP oil spill?
It is better than the BP oil spill, better than the 2010 midterm. It is worse than it's pretty high up there. I'll be honest about that.
So, Dan, you told me moments before we went on air that you didn't take a logic class on Georgetown, but I want to run you through a logic chain here. So,
I don't find out I needed that for my degree.
No, you'll be fine.
Just say cogito ergo sum.
You agree that Washington was gridlocked before with the array on Capitol Hill and your White House, right? There was gridlock, right?
Correct.
The president in his press conference now is being optimistic about breaking the gridlock when the new Congress comes back. Doesn't that mean logically that it is better for the president's agenda to have Mitch McConnell as leader than Harry Reid?
No, it does not mean that. What it means is that after the election, Senator McConnell offered some hope that he wanted to work with us, and we'll see where that goes. I would say that we are hopeful but realistic about the larger political dynamics in the Republican Party that have prevented compromise to date.
But you agree you're going to get big things done, right? You're optimistic. You'll get big things done.
We're hopeful that the opportunity is there.
So,
but you weren't
getting big things done with Harry Reid. So doesn't it make sense that this is good for you to say that you think this is good for you to get big things done?
No, let me be very clear. It is we would be in a much better place with the Democrats in charge of the Senate for our agenda, for the country. We fought very hard for that.
You had that for the last couple of years.
We were in 2012. We were hopeful things would get done after the election. Speaker Boehner, Senator McConnell said many of the same things that they said they've said since then, and you know we didn't end up with action. If you took what Speaker Boehner said in November of 2012 as gospel, then immigration reform would be
wrong. You mean 2010? You mean
that didn't happen. I mean 2012.
After the presidential.
After the presidential, you could do it in 2010, 2012. What I think the one lesson we know is that as we're in with these Republican Congresses, we got to wait till they're in there with their caucus. We hear what pull the Tea Party caucus has. What's it going to mean in the Senate when Ted Cruz and Rand Paul start running for president and trying to push things one way or the other? But what we're going to do is look for every opportunity to work with them to try to get something done. If we can do that, we know it's going to be hard. It's going to take a lot of effort on our part. It's going to require some change in behavior on their part as well. And if we get something done, that would be great. That's what's good for the country. As the president said, we got 2 years. Let's take every opportunity we can to try to move the ball forward, either through Congress or on our own.
Okay, so Dan, about a year and a half ago at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the president mocked the idea of having a drink with Mitch McConnell. Yesterday, he offered to have a bourbon with Mitch McConnell, but admitted that he had no idea what Mitch McConnell's drink of choice was. 24 hours later, I know you guys have a whole team of researchers. Does the president now know what Mitch McConnell's drink of choice is?
I think it is a safe assumption that bourbon will be the drink of choice of any politician from Kentucky.
No, but I'm talking about the particular cocktail that Mitch McConnell favors.
Bourbon-based cocktail.
Do you not know that?
I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay, I'm going to help you out here, all right, just because this is something you guys should have figured out in the last 24 hours. It's a Manhattan, okay? Make the man a Manhattan, and you'll get that will be the key to getting a lot of work done, okay? Tell the president that later,
I have to say... I have to say, if I had known a Manhattan was the cocktail choice of the Senator McConnell, that might have been... I suspect that might have been something that DSCC could have used in an ad.
Dan, the Republicans, one of the things they keep saying now is there's too much federal regulation on businesses in America. Does the president agree with that? And if so, give me one or two he thinks are too onerous on business he'd like to change.
Well, I mean, we have had a process in place for a long time to go and look for specific regulations that we that. We call it a regulatory look back. I'm sure there's probably a better name if it hadn't come out of OMB. But we go
Frank
back and
Luntz hates
ask all the agencies.
Name.
I have no doubt. Yeah. Go through the right. books, see what we can find and take off.
So
there's been a number of them.
So he agrees with
that.
He agrees with them. There are too many federal regulations on business, right?
He agrees that there are some regulations that may not make sense and we should get rid of.
So right now, just give me one.
I'll give you one that we have done already.
One going forward. Because you say you agree with the Republicans on a very high priority for them. Too much regulation on business. You have this ongoing process. What's one that you'd like to work with Republicans on? Because you agree that's a bad regulation.
I don't know. If this is going to become part of a negotiation with Republicans, I'm certainly not going to do that here with you now. But we have gone through the books. We have taken some off, and we'll look for more. And if Republicans have ideas of the regulations that they want to reform, they should bring them forward. What we're not going to do is go back to the world where Wall Street writes its own rules, polluters can do whatever they want, and corporations can do anything they want at all, because that doesn't make sense. But if there are specific things that don't make sense, we'll absolutely talk to them.
Dan, you have a specific list you're going to bring to the table. Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is that we have a process to look for regulations. We ask our cabinet to go through, find ones there.
Okay.
They bring them back to our Office of Management and Budget. But if Republicans have suggestions, they should certainly bring them. If they make sense to us, we'll work with them on that.
Okay, I'm a little obsessed with the press conference yesterday, so I'm going to ask another question about that. At the end of the press conference, the president suggested that he let John Boehner win that one time they played golf together before. Can you confirm that the president actually tanked that golf game when he played with Boehner before?
No. Well, he and Boehner were on the same side in that golf game. I think the president was being a little tongue-in-cheek.
Okay.
Boehner is an excellent golfer.
Yeah, who's got a lower handicap, the president or Boehner?
I believe Boehner does.
Who's more likely to take a mulligan?
Boehner's an excellent golfer.
Who's more likely to take a mulligan?
What's that?
Who's more likely to take a mulligan?
I think I was not part of the foursome.
Dan, you want to no comment
neither
this
of
one.
Them. I was going to say neither of them.
Try to be honest about this, Dan.
It's like a pseudo no comment.
All right, Dan, you are known as Mr. Optimism. So sketch this out. For the next 2 months through New Year's in this lame duck session, sketch out your most optimistic portrait of what will happen for the country regarding the congressional action and the president's behavior.
Sure. Let me say a couple of specific things. One, I think, is if we can get the funding we need to deal with Ebola both in Africa and here at home, it's very important to get done. If we can be able to make progress on an authorization for use of military force against ISIL, that would be progress. We have a lot of nominations that are backed up, and we want to try to get through those in the Senate, working with Senator Reid. And then we also, I think, can begin building the foundations to try to get stuff done next year when the Republicans come in. The meeting the president's having with the leadership tomorrow is the start of that.
Dan Pfeiffer, assistant to the president and senior advisor, thank you. When we come back, we'll answer a question that's been puzzling scholars for generations. Who exactly is Addison Mitchell Mitch McConnell Jr.?
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. Progress is everyone's business.
When a supplier of pipes, valves, and fittings for the energy industry turns to Goldman Sachs for capital and advice, business expands. New distribution centers open. Jobs are created. A global network takes shape. Millions of people get the energy they need. And a company called MRC Global makes progress.
Breitling, instruments for professionals.
Gunderman Group.
Gunderman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
The goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups. They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time? Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 Awesome. Awesome.
I love logistics.
Tonight, our look at a man in the news this week. He's making headlines, talking from the heart about his vision for our future. His name, Mitch McConnell. He's just a simple man, a senator from Kentucky, and currently the minority leader of the United States Senate. Soon, though, he'll be the new majority leader. Who is this bold new force? We asked Bloomberg's Doug Krisner to find out.
Are you having a good time?
That voice. His voice, our voice, heard around the nation, a nation hungry, ravenous for change, a nation that had found its oracle, its champion, its man for all seasons.
Hello, I'm Senator Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell, an unlikely leader from an unlikely time, with an untimely likeness, who yearns to make real for the nation one eternal dream.
And by having a Senate that actually, excuse me, that actually works.
Born to humble roots in the self-effacing soil of Sheffield, Alabama, little Mitch, cute as a button, would grow up to be an intern for Senator John Sherman Cooper, who would spark the flames of participatory democracy in a young man whose soul was searching for an ember of meaning. In 1984, McConnell brought together two of the most powerful forces in modern life, television advertising and man's best friend.
Switch to Mitch McConnell for U.S. Senate.
He quickly rose through the ranks of the Republican Party, earning stripes for his vigor. A hero who walked along to a star-spangled soundtrack for his intrepid life. A kingmaker, lifted largely on the laurels of his lofty language.
We believe Mitt Romney is the man for this moment.
As he braces for the soldiering task of being the majority leader in the world's greatest deliberative body, Mitch McConnell's strongest weapon may very well be his unwavering command and his irrefutable charm in tackling the most pressing issues of the day.
I will vote against the voting cloture, and I'd like to explain why.
But just remember that beneath his macho shell lies a temperament and wit of a quipster who loves nothing more than a wry, sophisticated jape in the spirit of his fellow wordsmith, Mark Twain.
The President of the United States is treating our Constitution worse than a placemat at Denny's.
And now you know. We'll be right back.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by BP, proud to be America's largest energy investor.
When folks think about what they get from Alaska, they think salmon and energy. But the energy BP produces up here creates something else as well. Jobs all over America. Engineering and innovation jobs, advanced safety systems and technology, shipping and manufacturing. Across the United States, BP supports more than 250,000 jobs. When we set up operation in one part of the country, people in other parts go to work. That's not a coincidence. It's one more part of our commitment to America.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
When a company committed to a sustainable future turns to Goldman Sachs for financing and advice, research is funded, algae gets to work, manufacturing ramps up, more facilities come online, renewable oils start providing new solutions, and a company called Solazyme makes progress.
Try the new Bloomberg Business Week Plus app for Samsung phone and tablet and get your first year of Bloomberg Business Week free. You'll get deeper intelligence on global business, innovative companies, technology trends, and exclusive behind-the-scenes videos and interviews. Start your free Bloomberg Business Week Plus subscription on your Samsung device today.
Unlike the past couple of days, we are only live on television 24 hours, 20, half an hour every day. But we are live 24-7 on BloombergPolitics.com, and we are always tweeting and Facebooking and all that spiffy social stuff. There's a great story on BloombergPolitics.com called The Cognitive Dissonance Election. It's an interactive graphic. Talks about how we got conservative Republicans in there, but also voters voted for more marijuana, fewer abortion restrictions, higher minimum wages, and more gambling.
Our man Phil Mattingly has a great piece on President Obama. Take a look at that. You can also follow us on Twitter. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next week right here. Sayonara.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success.